Hi, and welcome to In the Studio. I'm Redbeard with the stories behind history's greatest rock and roll albums.
You're welcome. Guitar up. One, two, three.
Today we're in the studio with the legendary band whose gritty blues-based music established the sound of Southern rock. The deepest roots of rock and roll are planted in the American South, in the wailing rhythms of the Delta blues, the twanging guitars of 50s rockabilly. Without the sounds of the South, without Howlin' Wolf and Muddy Waters, without Jerry Lee Lewis and Elvis Presley, rock and roll simply would not exist. But as rock swept the world in the 1960s, many people forgot its roots. When they thought about rock and roll, they thought about London, or Los Angeles, or San Francisco. They didn't think about places like Macon, Georgia, or Daytona Beach, Florida. They certainly didn't think about the South, not until they heard about the Allman Brothers Band. The original Allman Brothers Band, in their all-too-brief moment of glory, were considered by many to be the finest rock and roll band this country had ever produced. Certainly, their myth has been magnified by Duane Allman's tragic death, but there can be no doubt that he was one of the finest guitar players that ever lived. Duane Allman's guitar duets with Dickie Betts were the stuff that legends are made of, and it's easy to understand why the Allman Brothers have such an important place in the history of rock and roll. It was Greg Allman, a year younger than Duane, who got the fever first, though. Greg was about 12 years old then, living in Daytona Beach, Florida.
I met this guy named Floyd Miles, who's still a very dear friend of mine, and he took me literally across the tracks of town. And back then, I mean, like 1960, it wasn't cool to go over to Blacktown, you know what I mean? And he took me to this combination drugstore, barbershop, 7-Eleven, convenience store, record shop, everything, all in one room, right? And there was this big bin in there full of records, and they were on sale for like, I think they were on sale for a buck. And he starts going through and he says, well, this is Sonny Boy Williamson. This is Jimmy Reed. This is Otis Redding. This is Howlin' Wolf. And the music was gutsy, man, and it had something to hold on to, you know. I just became totally infatuated with it. And every dime I got went to that record store. And I was sitting at home learning them licks, learning to play. And by now, I really had the fever bad. And my brother was getting it. And then he quit school and passed me up in like an afternoon. Now, he was a natural, man.
The brothers formed their first band when Duane was 15, Greg was 14. Even then, Duane's gift for guitar playing was undeniable, and Greg soon had the good sense to switch to keyboards.
I got me a keyboard, and it sat on the stage, except for two songs. And we had people coming up to the band saying, you know, what, is some guy out sick or something, you know? There's nobody behind the piano over there. It was needed, so I volunteered for it because I had started singing, which was a sideline from guitar playing. And so I figured I did that, I might as well do this too. Plus, I was starting to get interested in writing, even though the first 500 or 600 tunes I ever wrote wound up in the garbage. They were just contrived crap, you know? I mean, I'd sit down and slave over it all night and wake up the next day, and I remember a bunch of times I'd go and show it to my brother, and he'd say, well, that's real nice, man. That's different words to this old Stones song or something, you know? It was pretty disheartening, but I kept at it.
In 1965, Duane and Greg Allman formed their first professional band, which they christened the Allman Joys. Greg Allman recalls the first step on that long, hard road to stardom.
We set out on July 4th, 1965 to go and seek our fortune, I guess. And because the band had been together since about March, but they all stayed in Daytona Beach so I could finish high school. I don't know why. For some reason, I thought it was definitely imperative that I finish high school just in case. Just in case the competition was too much out there and I had to, you know, get a job. So we went to, our first place we went to was Mobile, Alabama. Oh, God. They had, like, chicken wire up in front of the stage, you know, to keep the beer bottles from hitting you. And I mean, it was redneck. Oh, they had hired us and they'd gotten a picture of us, and by now we all had long hair. And back then, that was a little early for long hair. So they had on the right of the contract that if they didn't so much as like our looks when we got there, they could pay us a week's salary and send us on our way immediately. As it was, they held us over for 22 weeks. We had a good band, bro. We still do.
drinking in some crosstown bar. Sometimes I feel.
I was staying in this house. My brother was staying with this girl that he knew, right? He was like crashing there. And she had a baby. I didn't know where I was. I woke up in the middle of the night with this tune in my head, I couldn't find the light switch. So I found this ironing board and this box of kitchen matches, right? So I would strike one match and then strike another and blow it out. And I wrote it on this ironing board cover with the charcoal. I'd light the match and blow it out. So, yeah, I'd get about 1.5 words out of each match, you know. So I caught mucho hell for it the next day when she woke up and found her ironing board cover all ruined. But there it was, you know, and at least I had it all down. So the next morning I copied it down on paper. By nightfall, we had learned it and had it all the way down. I wonder where that ironing board cover is today. I'd like to have it back, really.
The Allman Joys broke up in 1967, and Greg and Duane headed for Los Angeles. There they formed a band called Hourglass and signed with Liberty Records, but they had no control over the songs they recorded, and they weren't allowed to record any of their own material. Duane, disgusted by the situation, quit the band and headed back south, becoming a session guitarist in Muscle Shoals, Alabama, then moving to Jacksonville. Greg, locked in by contractual obligations, was forced to stay in L.A. It was nearly a year before he and his brother were together again.
Just as I was about to lift a gun to my head, the phone rang. It was my brother. I'll never forget. It was March 23rd, 1969. I'll never forget it. There's my brother, and he said, "Man, I'm tired of being a robot down here." And he said, "I got to get back on the stage." And he said, "Dig it, I've found these four other guys." And I said, "Really, tell me about them." And he said, "Well, one of them's name's Dickie Betts. Plays an incredible lead guitar." And I didn't say anything, but I thought, "Well, what the hell are you going to do?" You know? And he said, "Well, I got two drummers." And I thought, "Man, he's really, really lost it now." And he said, "Then I got this guy named Oakley. That's a killer bass player." And he said, "What I need you to do," and this is probably the finest compliment I've ever had before or since. He said, "They don't sing very much and they don't write hardly at all. So I need you to come out here and round this boy up and send it somewhere, you know." And I said, "Well, let me hang up the phone so I can get my thumb out, you know." So he sent me a plane ticket and I put it in my back pocket and hitchhiked out there. Got a ride all the way from the San Bernardino Freeway to Jacksonville, Florida. From a guy who was a bass player who wanted a job, and we got there, and my brother says, "Thanks for bringing my little brother home." He slams the door in the guy's face. I've been away from my brother for 11 months, and during that time, he learned how to play slide guitar. I mean, he just was barely touching on it before, and he'd gotten real good. So I go in there, and there's two sets of traps set up, you know, two full sets of drums, and two lead guitar players and a bass player, and I'm thinking, God, this is either going to be real good, real bad. But knowing my brother, you know, I figured it was going to be good, but I didn't figure it was going to be that good. So they haul on their instruments, and they had the song Trouble No More, the old Muddy Waters song. And so there was no singer, so they just did the track to it, right? And they hand me the lyrics on the piece of paper, right? And I mean, it was so incredible. They got through with it. And I was just standing there dumbfounded. And I got my brother over to the side and I said, "Look, man, I'm not real sure if I can cut this or not, you know. You might want to look for somebody better than me." And he came all apart, you know. He said, "You know, you little..." After I told these guys all about you, "You know, this is an earshot to them, right?" And he, you know, said just the things that big brothers can, man, just enough to make me so mad. I snatched the words out of his hand. I said, "Count the damn thing off."
In addition to Greg, Duane and Dickie Betts, that original Allman Brothers lineup included bass player Barry Oakley and drummers Butch Trucks and Johnny Johansson. The band started playing gigs around the South, particularly Atlanta. Duane's reputation from his session playing days had attracted a number of record executives and prospective managers. Among them was Phil Walden, who managed singers such as Otis Redding and Percy Sledge. Walden was putting his own label together in his hometown of Macon, Georgia, and was on the lookout for a white blues band. The Allman Brothers were the first act to sign with his Capricorn Records.
They asked me, "Well, what have you got written?" So I had 22 songs with me. I started going through them, and they're all sitting around the room, you know, and I'd finish one, and they'd, "Yeah, well, what else have you got?" You know, and it was getting up to the wire there, you know. I was sweating bullets. I thought, God, I've lost this job and got it in the same day. The last two songs I played for them were Dreams and It's Not My Cross to Bear. And with that, we rehearsed them, learned them around the spot, pow. The next day, I wrote Whipping Post, and something else. I got really on a roll then, and because, you know, I had attained so much peace of mind. I was so glad to be out of L.A. and back with my own kind and what have you. that I just, hell, I couldn't find enough paper to write.
Just one more morning, I had to wake up with the blues, pull myself out of bed, yeah. Put on my walking shoes, went up on the mountain to see what I could see.
yourself together. Put on a new face. Climb down off the hilltop, baby. Get back in the race. 'Cause I'm a hunger.
That's Greg Allman's Dreams from the first Allman Brothers Band album. Up next, we'll hear how hard it was to make those dreams come true. I'm Redbeard. You're in the studio with the Allman Brothers Band first two albums.
Hi, I'm Greg Allman, and you're in the studio.
Thank you, Greg. This week, focusing on the debut from the Allman Brothers Band and their second, Idlewild South. I'm Redbeard. In the All Music Guide, Bruce Eder says this about the Allman Brothers' debut. This might be the best debut album ever delivered by an American blues band. A bold, powerful, hard-edged, soulful essay in electric blues with a Native American ambiance. There isn't a bad song here, and only the fact that the group did even better the next time out keeps this from getting the highest possible rating. And Eder goes on to say about the second album, Idlewild South, in his 5-star review, the best studio album in the Allman Brothers' history. Electric blues with an acoustic texture, virtuoso lead, slide, and organ playing, and a killer selection of songs. End quote. The early Allman Brothers albums did not sell particularly well outside of the South. It wasn't until the classic Live at Fillmore East album in 1971 that the band became truly popular on a nationwide scale. It was in the beginning word of mouth that built the Allman's audience and spread their reputation as one of the best live bands anyone had ever seen. Here's Greg Allman.
Yeah, we had some rough road trips back then. We had bought us a Winnebago camper that we absolutely just drove into the ground. We had some pretty rough gigs. Before that, we were traveling. We had an Econoline van, and we were in there like hot dogs, you know, like head to toe. And I remember we had one long jaunt that went from, we got through playing one night in Philadelphia and drove to San Francisco to the Fillmore. And we had to go via Dallas because the snow was so bad. And I mean, by the time we got there, we were all just, oh God. I felt like it'd been some kind of time warp machine. So.
Please don't keep your wondering no longer. stronger. Please don't keep me wondering no longer. Oh, please don't keep me wondering no longer. I know you've never been in love before. Oh, oh, baby.
Their 1969 debut and 1970's Idlewild South. Neither had garnered significant radio airplay, which was still dominated by Top 40 AM back then. The Allman Brothers Band had only a couple of positive Rolling Stone reviews and some word of mouth from their live shows. It was their second album, Idlewild South, released in 1970, that began to establish the Allman Brothers' reputation outside of the South. The sound on Idlewild South wasn't as raw as it had been on the first Allman Brothers Band album, but Greg's songs were as potent and painful as ever. Among the songs on Idlewild South was one called Midnight Rider.
I had written Midnight Rider, and it came to me like all of a sudden. I think maybe less than 45 minutes, I had it finished. So I couldn't find anybody in the band, so I went and got two of our roadies. And I found J-Mo. And I found Twigs, the head roadie. And Twigs had never played bass before, so I put this bass in his hand, and I said, just go do-da-do, do-da-do. And when I make a sign with my hand, it stop, you know. So I'm cutting this demo with this guy that doesn't know how to play at all. And sure enough, he made it through it okay. And J-Mo played congas, and I played a 12-string guitar. And I took that and showed it to the band, and... Again, by nightfall, we had the whole song down. It almost felt like I had nothing to do with it after it was written. It was like being wonderfully possessed.
Silver dollar, but I'm not gonna let 'em catch me, no. elegant simplicity of Greg Allman's composition Midnight Rider on the Allman Brothers Band's second album, Idlewild South, wisely wasn't over-arranged and embellished by producer Tom Dowd. Turns out that Greg and Duane Allman had returned to their birthplace of Nashville for one summer early in the band's career to study songwriting under John D. Loudermilk, who wrote Tobacco Road, Abilene, and Indian Reservation. Here's Greg Allman.
We spent about a half of a whole summer at his house, the five of us, the four of us in the band and him, just kind of, I was fortunate enough to be able to sit and watch him write songs, you know, because I don't think there's any way that you can sit and teach somebody how to write songs. That's the way I picked up on it, and just watching him, you know, and like what he wrote about and about how, you know, certain things are fill words, and garbage truck, for instance, is not a fill word, and things like that, you know, and it was really very interesting.
Thank you.
written by Allman Brothers Band guitarist Dickie Betts. That's called In Memory of Elizabeth Reed, with its jazz and rock synthesis. An example of what legendary producer Tom Dowd called, and I quote, "the greatest fusion I've ever heard." I'm Redbeard with Greg Allman, and in the studio, the Allman Brothers Band.
Hi, I'm Greg Allman, and you're in the studio.
The summer before my brother passed away, all hell broke loose. I mean, here it came. It was so fast, man. I mean, money was coming from everywhere. Being the main writer, I was making like, you know, one, two and a half times more than everybody else. And I remember I had the guys over to my house one afternoon, and we were sitting there, you know, having a drink or what have you. One of my roadies wanted to buy this TV set that I had. So he picks it up, and I had stashed this check underneath it, right? And the Red Dog, I heard him say, man, look here under this TV. There's a check for $34,000 in here, man. And I'm going, oh, no, he found it. So he drags it in there, you know. So with that, I had written a song called, well, maybe it was before that, but somewhere in there, I wrote a song called Hot Lena, and I put everybody's name on it in the whole band. And because I was starting to feel weird about making that much more money than everybody else, because it never dawned on me that the writer would make more money, because, you know, hell, I was as new to it as everybody else.
Take one last look before you leave. To me, and if you ever need me, you know where I'll be. So please call home if you change your mind. Oh, I don't mind. I guess I saw it coming. But oh, I could not stand the failure. Before you leave, there's just one thing I must say. Please call home if you change. Change your mind. Ooh.
hot spots were Atlanta, of course. We never picked up quite as much on the Fillmore West. We never got quite as big out there as we did in the East. As a matter of fact, we never basically in along the eastern seaboard and just the eastern part of the country, we were bigger there than we were in the western part because we, you know, we frequented the East Coast a lot more. And New York City had become a real hot one, I guess because of the Fillmore East. Because we went and played there time and time again. We played the Fillmore East many, many times. We were like the opening act and then the third opening act and then second opening act. Finally, we headlined it, I think. Also, Cincinnati was a big place for us. A place called Ludlow's Garage. That was basically why we did just about everything. That's what we had to like hold on to, you know. And the music was always kick-ass from the very start.
So that was a real constant thing in our lives, you know. Without the music, if the music hadn't have been the way it was, then the brotherhood wouldn't have been the way it was. And the whole thing would have just collapsed a long time ago.
They didn't know it when they released that first album, but the Allman Brothers were about to change the face of American rock and roll. Their success meant that the roots of the music were as strong as ever, that, at least in terms of rock and roll, the South would rise again. And if there was an anthem from those early Allman Brothers days, it was the song called Whipping Post. I'm Redbeard. We'll be back in the studio after this.